Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, ethics and the agency dilemma. I will teach until about 2:30 and 2:35, and then I will open up the quiz for you to take, and when you're finished with it, as usual, that's all I will have for you, so you can leave. Again, as usual, though, we will do a look at the markets to have a look around. As you can see, we actually had it's a bearish day, and it's not just in the United States. As you can see, it's a global bearish day. I'm not sure what's really souring the markets around the world, but as you can see, the Nikkei is down, but actually by the end, and I was watching this, it was in the middle of the night here in the United States, but I was seeing that through the night, their day in Tokyo, that it was climbing, trying to recover from early losses, and it almost broke even, got back to where it started the day. Well, down only about 0.1%. And then you go over here and you see the Hang Seng wasn't quite as successful. There was some rallying, but it was very weak on that market. There had just been a lot of selling through the day, through their day. And I'm not sure what was going on. It was fairly broad-based on their exchange over there in Hong Kong. So hard to say, you know, what was going on. And I wasn't following their news particularly, but it did show up also over in Europe. As you can see, it was down, but it wasn't down really a spectacular amount, down about 0.5%. And then you go over, the sun rose over in Great Britain, and in London, that exchange was down, but you see it tried to recover. And here in the last hour or so, I think they're still trading over there. It's almost over for the day over there. They started dropping again. Just kind of hard to say. And that's kind of what's going on right now here, is that it wasn't too bad at first, but then the Dow began to fall off a cliff right around just before noon, and it ended up a bit down. Well, it's not quite done yet, I shouldn't say that, but right now it's down 1.5%, which is a pretty noticeable amount for the Dow, which is a slow-moving, lower-risk company, big, fat old companies, monopolies and oligopolies and all that. But then you look at the S&P 500, and it is tailing downward too, not quite as much, but there's a sell-off happening across the board right now, and it's been going on for a couple of hours now, that the sell-off seems to be accelerating today, at least right here in the United States. And the NASDAQ also, it's down too. Not as much, but which is kind of odd that the Dow is down more, but they're all in the middle of a sell-off right now. And how long that's going to last, I can't say, but it looks like it's going to continue at least through the end of trading, trading ends here in just a few hours. So whatever's going on, something has spooked the markets pretty heavily around the world, and especially here in the United States. If you come down here and look at the sector map, you'll see that most of the sectors are in red territory, even technology stocks, which are generally pretty chipper these days, pretty bullish sectors. You don't see it there today, just a few green splotches in an otherwise red field. So something is really upsetting the markets. And from what I hear, I talked to one of my former students who's a trader. I talked to him a couple hours ago, just briefly. He said, it's just everyone's in a bad mood. He said, I don't see it. I was asking, well, what's pissing everyone off? He said, I don't see anything. It's just everyone is in a sour mood now. And I said, well, is this long term? And he said, well, you know, no one knows right now. But if you come up here and have a look at the assets. Gold just keeps kind of floating around 4,000. It had a surge there a few days ago, but then it settled back down, so it's just kind of parked there at about $4,000 an ounce right now. And it seems like that's kind of a wait and see. But boy, those crude oil is now sticking below $60 a share, the overall index of crude oil prices. And it should be bringing down gas prices. It's not. And that's a question, you know, what's going on here. It's hard to tell. Another one, there are a couple of energy stocks here. Natural gas is another one. I haven't looked at that much this semester, but natural gas is another one of those that you keep an eye on, and it is also sinking in price too. And that seems to be on more sinking because of slack demand for natural gas right now. We did have a dry harvest, which means that there isn't as much natural gas being used to dry the corn and beans in the grain silos. So that would kind of contribute to a lower price for natural gas because there's not as much demand for it. But of course, households will still be using it. So these lower prices should be good news for households. I wanted to take you on a little bit. I've tried to show you different sectors, expose you, retail sector and banking sector and a few others. Let me take you on one that I've kind of ignored mostly this semester, is the transportation sector, and just show you some of the big players in the transportation sector. See if you get a feel for the betas of them and all of that. One that I would probably start with, which is pretty much expected, FedEx. Have a look at it. It's a pretty pricey stock at 263, and it has been, its beta is above one, enough that you say, okay, we're in kind of risky territory here, 1.34. That's getting out of the range of your typical normal kind of investors. It's speculative. Now notice that it does pay a dividend, and a not bad one either. I consider any dividend above about 1.5% to be, nice, a good dividend. And the company is profitable, obviously. And PE ratio, underpriced, undervalued, noticeably. For a company with a high beta, but it's undervalued, this might be something worth having a look at. Now, I want to show you something really dramatic about this one. Nope, it's not going to be this one. I was thinking of another one. But it's just one, if you're interested in the transportation sectors, FedEx is a classic that you look at. Another one that's kind of a classic is UPS. Notice it's down for the day too. It's sensitive to the market. And you see a beta that's above one. Not as much above one as FedEx is, but it's still above one. So it might be seeing a little bit of a pattern here in these. EPS is definitely undervalued. This company's stock is definitely undervalued. So in other words, we're also getting kind of seeing a pattern of these stocks being ignored right now. They're higher beta, but there doesn't seem to be any push to push, make the prices go up. And it's got kind of I thought that was a little higher than that. It's got a dividend. It's not a spectacular dividend. If my eyes are not deceiving me, let me get that bigger so I can see those dividends. Oh, that does have. I thought that one was the one with the high dividend. That's a really generous dividend on that stock. Now you don't have to do this, but just to have a quick check to see what's might be going on with the an annual holding period return. If I buy it today, in a year, I can cash it in for $103.62 divided by what I'm going to pay for it today, which here is 94.15. And then I minus 1, of course. And then I multiply that by 100 to get a percent. And then I add that very juicy dividend, which is 6.83% plus 6.83%. That's a decent return. It is a little above 1. It's not too bad. It's 1.1. So in other words, its volatility is about 110% of the world market. And in this case, it's going to give us a return of about 16.89% total holding period return between the appreciation of the stock, the capital gain, and the dividend you get, the dividend yield. You get it's not a bad buy. And this is the kind of thing, and I've said this over and over again, just these basic numbers. You look at these, and it can give you some guidance on whether or not it's a good investment. Let me show you a couple of others that are in the game, different ones. Now, let me take you over here. Union Pacific. This is transportation, but mostly of a different kind. And it was down today. Having a look at its beta, oh, isn't that interesting? It's exactly 1. In other words, in a well-diversified portfolio, this stock is as just the same volatility as the market portfolio. So this is one that's right there in the middle. Looks like it's a decent play. It's got a decent dividend of 2.48%. And we can look at the return on this one, just to do another one, just for the sake of showing you. Clear it. And then I'm going to take $260.42, what you would sell it at in a year, divided by buying it 1 year before, that is today, $220.93, minus 1. So the capital gain times 100, sorry. So the capital gain is a whopping 17.87%, and you add in that little that decent dividend of 2.48%. That's an outstanding return for a stock with a beta right smack on 1, 20.35%. Now, do you know what I shouldn't assume you know, but do any of you know what Union Pacific is mostly known for? Yeah.
Trains.
Yeah, rail. Yeah. And so there you go. Interestingly, same broad sector, transportation, but we see a company that is less risky than the typical, than the other companies, which are more inland transport, trucking, and you see that it actually is a very good return. Yeah.
Isn't UP getting ready to go in a merger with
North America? Is. It is. And so that's always a good sign. Matter of fact, let me really quick, I won't do any more of these, let me look really quick. And its P/E ratio is not bad. It's somewhat undervalued. It's got a pretty decent projected annual return, and the beta is right smack in the middle of risk. It moves just with the world portfolio, the market portfolio. So, I mean, if you were thinking about getting something in the transportation sector, and that's a good idea. If you're trying to diversify a portfolio, you try to buy across sectors. You would buy in biomedical, you would buy in high technology, you would buy in industrials, and transportation is a huge part of the economy, so you would certainly want to have something at least in the transportation sector. Now, there are other ones that I could have you look at, like another one is Ryder, CSX is another one, and there are a few others that are worth having a look at in there. However, the lesson here is that the point is look around the sector. You don't just say, well, I'm going to get something because I need something in transportation. You look at the various players, the big players, and you see which ones are better overall as investment targets. And in this case, having looked at three right now, I'm thinking, yeah, I would probably look at rail, and I might very seriously consider CSX as a, rather Union Pacific as a company to invest in. Enough of that for the day. The lecture today, I am required to have integrated into courses that I teach ethics. And this is obviously important because we're in the most ethical state you could imagine, Illinois. And I say that while trying to keep a straight face. Illinois, at the governance level, has historically been one of the most corrupt states in the nation. But we forgive and we forget. And I'm supposed to bring up ethics, so I do so with sort of a zeal in this. I have, for part of this lecture, the part that has to do with agency, a PowerPoint presentation that mirrors my lecture. And it's called Agency. It's a PowerPoint presentation in your files folder in Canvas. So follow along with me when I get to that part, but also know that I do cover that in that PowerPoint presentation. But before I get to the agency, that agency, I want to address ethics in a broader framework. Because right now, in the world of business, an emphasis has been growing on corporate governance. And that means governance that is ethical, that emphasizes ethical action at the level of the C-suite, at the level of the board of directors. And by doing things ethically at that level, the hope is that it translates down the management chain to you. But the problem is that, and in fact, there is such an emphasis on ethics that the state of Illinois, among the certifications I have to do every year, they have one that is a long, grueling certification in ethics. The great flaw in that is that it is a battery of panels and PowerPoint slides and lectures on following the law. In other words, ethical behavior is being made synonymous with law, with abiding by the law. And there is a specific set of laws on ethics in Illinois and in almost every state. So I am ethical if I know the laws in the state of Illinois that have to do with ethics. And that's absolutely ridiculous. Ethical action is separated from legality of action. And that's something that I have to emphasize. When we deal with governance, corporate governance, we can't just say, well, we are in compliance with the law, so we are ethical. That is actually, at the civil level, that is folly. Well, you can't sue us for this product's defects because everything we did was within regulations. So we're in the clear. Absolutely not. Constitutional law separates abiding by regulations with acting in a way that indemnifies you against civil actions. So we have to start with that. In this framework, I'm going to put up a square matrix. Now, on the top, there are legal actions and illegal actions. In the sides, there is ethical and unethical. Now, one thing that I have to frame here is that we use the word ethics as a substitute for the word moral. Because we want to separate what ethics, your actions in the civil society, from your actions that are directed by religious beliefs. So we tend to avoid moral and immoral, and we focus on ethical and unethical in this. Now, in this framework, you can have actions that are legal and ethical. What is lawful is also what is ethical to do. You file your taxes. That's ethical, but it's also legal. You comply with safety standards. That's ethical and it's legal to do that. However, there are actions that are illegal, but they are ethical. Whistleblowers face this all the time, in blowing the whistle on especially government employees who give away secrets. And when they give those away, they are prosecuted for violating secrecy standards. So they are doing what is illegal, but they're doing it for ethical reasons. Examples are many. I'll give you one. A worker at the DOJ some years back, she had a very odd name. Her name was Reality Winner. She was going through files on flash drive, I think it was, and she saw footage from a policing activity when we were fighting in Iraq. And she saw it was a takedown of a group of people. All of them were killed by American snipers. And they said, well, this was a group of terrorists. If you look at the video, it wasn't. It was just several guards walking along protecting some civilians, including children, and all of them were butchered. And so she released it. She saw it as her ethical duty to let the families know that they were killed for a wrongful reason. She went to prison for many years for that. It was illegal for her to leak that file because it was a war file, but it was the right thing to do in her mind. There's a problem, though. In her mind, it was. So ethical action has a subjective component. And then there are actions that are legal, but quite ethical to do. You're doing something. You're complying with the law when you do it. But is it ethical? When we give Elon Musk $1 trillion, is that an ethical action? Most people would say, like hell, that's ethical. For a run-of-the-mill car company CEO who has all kinds of big ideas, he buys companies and then runs a lot of them into the ground, and the ones that are going because of the brilliance of the engineers and the scientists and the marketers and the salespeople. And then there are unethical and illegal actions. And some of those would be Jeffrey Epstein. What he did was illegal. He was trafficking in minors, and it was also unethical to do that to kids. So we see that there are blocks for a lot of different things here. And it's a good framework for starting. Where is your corporate governance? Where are your decisions going to fall in this framework? The company says you're doing this, and the lawyers say this is legal to do this, but you don't see it as an ethical action, or you are seeing something that is illegal, your company says don't do that, it's against the law to do that, but you see that as the right thing to do. Taking this framework a little further. The problem here is that the Renaissance, the late Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, we were beginning to see a separation attempted, moving away from religious reasons for doing things and putting them into a secular frame. You saw a lot of different places where this was going on, that taking it out of religious context. And it wasn't just Christianity. Judaism has faced this, and to some extent, certain sects of Islam are facing this too. Why can't we find a rational basis for action, for rightful action? Can we do that? And so early in this, we find the philosophers and the thinkers and the naturalists, which means scientists, looking for a forward-looking way of acting. And among those was Immanuel Kant. I think that's E. Just know the last name, Kant. Now, he was very... he may not have been the first, but he was very prominent. He was a great thinker of his time. He was highly respected. And he came up with something called the categorical imperative. Now, the categorical imperative, it was written in German, which means that it has a lot of subtlety. You can't bring it into English exactly. But it goes like this. Always act, and notice, always act as you would expect others. To act. Always act as you would expect others to act. Now, you say, well, that's just a golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. No, it's not. There is no you centering. Well, I want you to do this for me, so I'll do that for you. No, this is always to everything around you. In every situation, you always act in the way that you would want everyone else to act. This is a categorical. In other words, no exceptions. If you want them to behave like this, then you do that too. That's where you get that categorical, and it's an imperative. You must. And that still operates to this day to some extent, but we know human nature can't always do that. We see a lot of people who are hypocrites. Well, I think you're doing something wrong there. Well, you do that too. Well, we're not talking about me, we're talking about you. So you see that there is this slippage. If we could teach everyone in a society from the earliest ages to the categorical imperative, we would all be behaving in our personal and in our corporate lives quite well. Unfortunately, we are humans. By the time we get to the 19th century, we're beginning to see a lot of griping and fussing about the categorical imperative because it isn't good enough to answer every question we have about ethical action. You, sir, are the CEO of Mega Pharma Big Incorporated. You have found out, you know that your scientists have been working on a drug that saves children from a fatal disease. This disease, and these are called orphan drugs, it's a very well-known thing, orphan drugs are hard to fund because, I mean, it's not many kids or adults who have an illness. So research is not very thick on these kinds of cures and all that. You know that you are working on an orphan drug that will save children's lives. The disease that these kids have ends them in about 2 years. Your drug will keep them alive for a normal life, all the way. And you know that when you make the announcement that the clinical trials are finished, you're going to go up there on the podium tomorrow morning and you're going to announce it. And you know that your stock price is going to go through the stupid roof when you do that, right? Well, this woman is your chief scientist. She comes to you the night before, you're just getting ready to leave, and you're all excited about this announcement tomorrow, and she says, here's a problem. This drug saves the lives of, in 1,000 kids, it will save the lives of 999 of them. But in every 1,000, one will die in 6 weeks because of this drug. One will die in 6 weeks, but 999 kids will live full and complete lives, whereas they would have died in 2 years. And you've got to go before the shareholders tomorrow to make the announcement. What are you going to do? Are you going to say, we're going with this, or you're going to say, stop?
I feel like I need to talk to a lawyer.
Oh, no, you don't. You're alone. You're the CEO. You're very much alone with that nice big desk of yours and all that. What are you going to do?
It's a way more complicated trolley problem.
Interesting, isn't it? Let me try you. What would you do in this situation? You look at me like, screw you, man. I'm not going to let myself get in that situation. Okay. What would you do?
I also have no idea.
Well, you have to, because I'm making you the leaders. That's what this class is about. That's what we're doing here. That's why we have the high rank we do, is because we are expected to create strong leaders. And whatever you decide, the company is going to follow you. But the shareholders might want to hang you. So what are you going to do? I'll let you off the hook. What would you do, sir?
Do you get to pick which kid it is?
No. You're ugly. Well, I wish I could. But I got some kids. No. That's the first time I've ever been asked that question in all these years. What would you do? Well, here's the thing. Your job is to maximize shareholder wealth. That is your job. That is your one and only one duty. You're not there to maximize the welfare of the stakeholders, which is Pop Thad. Because the stakeholders can't fire you. The shareholders can hang you. Clearly, in order to fulfill your sole obligation, you are going to go ahead with it. But the question would be, let's say that in this situation, that you, sir, say, go with it. And then someone asks you, your child has this disease, doesn't he? What if he's the one who dies? He could have lived at least 2 years, but this drug will kill him in 6 weeks. You see, there is an ethical dilemma here that is killing us in this kind of situation. The truth of the matter is, a lot of products are brought off the market these days, not because they kill a lot of people, but because they harm a few people. So, and then there are other companies that just skid right by. And they know that there are problems with it. They know for years that there are problems with it. But they continue to produce it because it is good for the profit of the shareholders. Cigarettes were a classic example of that. The emerging industry of tetrahydrocannabinol products is an example of that. They know damn well this stuff is going to kill people in 20, 30, 40 years, but they're still pushing it. The same is true of many things. So we need something better. Situational ethics. Now this started emerging really in the 19th century. Later 19th century. We can't just have a categorical imperative. We have to look at the situation. Now you can take two strains on that. There is a strict version, which was promoted by a writer, education specialist, philosopher named John Stuart Mill, M-I-L-L. And then there were others who were non-strict. Among those, I would probably put Ralph Bellamy, B-E-L-L-A-M-Y. But either way, In this one, you have actually a named way. It's called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism has the flavor of situational ethics, but it still has a rule base to it. Utilitarianism is the greatest good for the greatest number. The greatest good for the greatest number. This is how democracies work. The greatest good for the majority. And we function on utilitarianism in most of our everyday behaviors and governance as an ethical framework. The dark side of this is that this allows for all kinds of evil against minorities. Racism, as long as the race being discriminated against is a minority, utilitarianism says it's okay. Sexism, as long as the majority is male and the females are weak in their ability to communicate their needs, then utilitarianism says, go with misogyny, go with sexism. The same goes for all kinds of different minority groups, from ethnicities, from religions, from sexual orientation. Utilitarianism says, the hell with the minority, the greatest good for the greatest number compels us to make these laws that discriminate against the minorities. But utilitarianism is very popular. Like I said, democracies operate on it. And then this non-strict version is more look at the situation itself. Don't make a rule. Maybe utilitarianism is fine for some things, but not for everything. You see, the utilitarian philosophy would say, go with this drug. But then, if you step over here into the non-strict version of situational ethics, you're awash in a sea of doubt. No matter what you do, you're not sure that this is the right thing to do. In one situation, you might do something that in another situation that looks kind of similar, you would not do it at all. So this is our framework in which we have to talk about ethics in the corporate world. And that brings us to the agency dilemma, which is in that PowerPoint presentation, and I will complete this lecture on Wednesday. But for now, what I want you to do is sign into your archive and then proceed to take the quiz. And when you're finished with it, that's all I have for you. I thank you.